On ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web, this is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hello there and thanks for joining us. Well, with Christmas approaching with its story of the baby and the manger in the stable, tonight we're going to ask a couple of questions about the stable door, at least the state of the stable door, as we end another year with a Western Christianity. In our second hour, Francis Sullivan of the Catholic Truth, Justice and Healing Council will be with us to talk about their just-released activity report into the Church's response to the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse. Then Andrew West of the Religion and Ethics Report will be talking with historian Professor Randall Barmer about his new biography of United States President Jimmy Carter, who turned 90 this year. There'll be a quiz. Rachel Konzak will be journeying to ancient Pompeii for a look at some of the fabled mystery cults. And then in the chat room, Dr. Bill Ledbetter of Perth will be along to take your calls. So let's begin. Busy night, good fun for all. Here's Tony Bennett and a beautiful version of Kurt Weill's Lost in the Stars.
Before Lord God made the sea or the land, he held all the stars in the palm of his hand, and they ran through his fingers like grains of sand. And one little star fell alone. Then the Lord God hunted through the wide night air for the little dark star on the wind down there. And he stated and promised he'd take special care so it wouldn't get lost no more. Now a man don't mind if the stars get dim and the clouds blow over and darken him, as long as the Lord God's watching over them, keeping track how it all goes on. But walking through the night and the day, till my eyes get weary and my head turns gray. And sometimes I think maybe God's gone away, forgetting his promise and word he'd say. And we're lost out here in the stars, little stars, big stars, blowing through the night. And we're lost out here. Blowing through the night, and we're lost out here in the stars.
Tony Bennett, and of course Kurt Weill's Lost in the Stars. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. In recent years, while the impact of religion on global politics has been increasing, the decline in formal religious practice in the West continues unabated. Churches have been talking about it since the 60s, but confronting the reality of the church in a post-Christian world, well, that is still for many a bridge too far. Tonight, we confront the question, whither the church? And to do so, we're joined by Dr. Philip Hughes of the Christian Research Association, Di Carmody, a social worker and active Catholic layperson, also, a social worker at the Children's Hospital. And also, we're joined by Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Monash University, Dr. Gary Boomer, and Dr. Keith Suter, who still, I believe, is a member of the Club of Rome, an active member of the Uniting Church, and recently published, I think, his third PhD on the future of the Uniting Church in Australia. Welcome to you all.
Good evening.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Philip Hughes, perhaps first I could come to you and ask you, what is the state of play at the end of this year with conventional church practice as it's known in Australia? Is church attendance continuing to decline as a percentage of population?
It's hard to get exact figures, but certainly over the last 10 years there's been a very slight decline. We reckoned in 2002 that around about 18 or 19% of people around Australia, adults, attended religious services monthly or more often. And the latest survey that I've been able to look at for 2012 indicated it was about 17%. Now, that's churches and other religions. So if you take out other religions, and we're talking just about the churches, it's probably round about 15%, which is what another survey in 2009 found.
How does that compare internationally, say with the UK?
Not all that different, in fact. It's UK, there's slightly more identifying, but there's possibly slightly less actually attending regularly.
Right. The country we should, I guess, point to as being slightly different here, although it may be catching up in the next few years, is the United States.
Yes, and certainly there is a higher percentage there, although there's also a lot of debate about exactly how high that percentage is.
Mm. Give us a picture then of, say, other social institutions. How, for instance, let's take the other great sort of religious tradition in Australia, sport. How does religious adherence compare to sport in Australia?
Well, if you take a particular and one of the larger sports like AFL in Melbourne, and that's where we've done our figures, certainly we find that more people in Melbourne are involved in churches on any given weekend that are than attend a sporting AFL match.
Now, hang on, Gary. I think you need to repeat that for our audience, particularly our wide and enthusiastic ABC sports audience.
Sure. Yes. On any one weekend, there's more people attending churches than are attending an AFL football match.
But if you put in your TV audience on that, you might get a different figure.
Oh, yes.
More people will be watching it on TV than they'll be watching what goes on at their local Anglican church.
Yes.
Well, that may sure. well be the case. The other interesting thing, Philip Hughes, before we move to widen this conversation, is the way in which, as Gary Boomer indicated then, that our listening viewing habits may be different. Like, for instance, last year, for the first time in probably a couple of generations, ABC television had no recognition of religion at Christmas time, when for years past it had always been either an Australian local carols and readings or one from King's College, Cambridge. Nothing last year and nothing really remarked about.
And what that reflects is perhaps the confidence and interest in religion in the wider community. So if you take the levels of confidence, for example, in 2002, 34% of the population said they had a reasonable level of confidence. In 2011, that was down to 22%. So there's been a significant decline in the regard for the churches in the wider community. But in actual fact, if you actually look at the numbers of people attending church as distinct from the percentage, you're actually finding a rise. So the numbers actually attending churches is continuing to increase in our community, just as the numbers identifying as Christian is also gradually increasing, though the percentage is dropping.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio. We're talking about wither Christianity. The coming of a post-Christian era, has it already arrived? Dr. Gary, well, we've talked to Dr. Philip Hughes about the figures. Dr. Gary Bomer is one who's just recently done a report for the Anglican Diocese in Melbourne. But before we go to Melbourne, let's take a moment to talk to Keith Suter about the situation facing the Uniting Church, because you've actually done something quite in depth. You've actually done a PhD on this very question, that is the future of one of Australia's big three religious denominations. Is that the future as an institution, Keith, that we're
talking
about?
That's right, yes. Here? I've sort of focused on the Uniting Church. When I'd be saying to people that I was doing something on the future of the Uniting Church, the joke was it'll be a very short doctorate, which is true if you look at the numbers in congregations. But on the other hand, if you were to bring together all of the aged care, childcare, etc. work, all the social work in the Uniting Church, put it into one corporation, it would be larger the 90 or perhaps 95% of the companies listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. So the Uniting Church is very, very, very big in the provision of social welfare. Sure, a declining number of congregational members, but a vast amount of work. As the governments continue to outsource their work, the Uniting Church picks up the contracts. Now, what I've done is to use scenario planning, which is a management technique for thinking about the future. It's the first time it's been applied to the future of an Australian church, and I've come up with four futures. With scenario planning, you don't make predictions. You say to the readers, these are potential four possibilities. One is that we amalgamate all of our small congregations into what I call a word and deed ministry. So a smaller number of larger churches providing services throughout the entire week, but not only religious, but also social welfare.
Uniting Church's mega church.
That's right. Number two, a second scenario is that we just let the congregations fade away and we just concentrate on the social welfare work, and we will be one agency, perhaps Uniting Care, it could be called, with a Christian heritage.
That's the path that several years ago, a generation
Mission Australia. Exactly.
They decided to close their congregations as the old Melbourne City Mission, Sydney City Mission, and become Mission Australia, which is now one of the up there in headlights social agencies.
Absolutely.
In the
country. And they avoid all the politics of congregational life. A third option is to divorce off the social welfare work and the university colleges, etc., and just concentrate on what I call the emerging church. This whole new separate series of initiatives, badly organized, cafe church, all these sorts of movements. So it's a pre-Constantinian approach to Christianity, because what I've found interesting is that although people don't like the church, they do love Jesus. A huge amount of interest in Jesus. More books being published on Jesus now than ever before. Huge market, huge interest in Jesus. So in other words, you then create or make the most of this new opportunity. The fourth scenario is you simply wind up the Uniting Church. You need an exit strategy which will enable the bits that are flourishing, such as the welfare work, the Uniting Church schools, most of them anyway, Uniting Church university colleges, to then leave and create separate identities for themselves.
Gary Bomer, you're familiar with the broad scenarios that Keith is painting. You've had a look at these very questions for the Anglican Church in Melbourne. Are you seeing many of the same options emerging?
I see a variety of responses, but I see a slightly different thing going on, and that is a For British Protestants in particular, the time from 1850 to 1960, 110 years of great success as they were tied to industrialization, urbanization, the spread of the British Empire, and professionalization. Those kinds of drivers were very much at the root of the success. Now, as things toddle over, the numbers may look good in attendance, but if you walk into these places, they're pretty elderly. You didn't get going on the age structure of these attenders. Most of them couldn't even get to a footy match. It's a shocking thing to see, and it gives a kind of experience to somebody walking into church now that says, well, why would I go there? What service am I looking for? And whereas, 50 years ago, churches provided all kinds of services, from dances to movies to places where you met spouses and things like that, it isn't where that stuff happens anymore. There's a whole variety of alternative providers out there. The church has competition for those and is, in a sense, pushed back to something like core business. The problem was, when the church looked at core business, it said, that's something we do on the inside, and it closed in on itself, and it kept looking inside and tried to pretty it up so maybe more people would come in rather than continuing the engagement. And so you get the kind of split that Keith was talking about. You've got worship going on here and you got social service over there. It's a very common problem because those things have been dissociated, and you don't go to a congregation for serious social service. What do you go to a congregation for? For worship, nurture, growth in faith, yes. But what do you get if you walk in? What most British Protestant churches is a wash of blue rinse, gray heads, and something that isn't terribly current.
Something that needs to be translated, in fact, that's right. for the new entrant into the room.
Exactly. We haven't got something that's so post or pre-Constantinian, as at least it's not 19th century anymore. And it's a whole new game where it's no longer normal to believe, no longer normal to attend, no longer normal for this to be part of the conversation. Like you say, it's not even on the ABC. Christmas doesn't feature on the ABC. That's part of the new normal. How does the church operate in that? Does it close in on itself, or does it reach out, find new ways of going out? And so a book that CRA has just published with Philip and myself and Gerald Rose, called Reimagining Church, examines 43 different creative responses to this environment, trying to create new experiential encounters where people engage with each other and with God in a variety of ways, both within what might look like a traditional church structure and outside it. And these are quite exciting and interesting and point to the fact that there is not one way forward. It's not just decline. It's not just shut the door. It's not just happy clappy stuff, although all of these things are on the agenda for various places. There is a place for creative engagement with people who are searching for an encounter, an experiential encounter with God.
By Carmody, let me bring you in here. As a participant in the Catholic Church all of your adult life, you've seen the change, you've felt the change. You have in Pope Francis somebody who seems to actually say, I recognize the change.
Yes.
And a discussion is happening in the Catholic Church that's broadly called the New Evangelization, which in some ways picks up a number of the themes that have echoed here. That is this about what we do inside the doors, or is it about how we engage with the world? Is that your experience just growing up as a Catholic, of the dilemmas that the church faces?
Yes, it is. And I think one of the ways to deal with that is to involve women far more in both the management and the organisation and the reaching out that everybody's been talking about. Everybody who wants to engage with God also wants to engage with a community. They're looking for a communal experience, and that I can see that it's very sad if you go into a church and find that there's nobody that you could really relate to or talk to. I do understand that. I think in every church, including the Catholic Church, the young are not going as nearly as often as they used to, and the older people probably are going less as well, because they're finding what they're hearing from the pulpit isn't really very encouraging or enlightening or exciting. So we do have to look at both sides of it and bring people together. And talking to my 93-year-old aunt in Brisbane today, what she said is, we need the women to get in there and help us do it, because women can really help build a communal spirit and an engagement that people really want to address. The other thing is, in my experience, though, in contrast, we have a lot of younger people in my local church, mostly immigrants, mostly people who've come particularly from Asian countries. There is a very strong move amongst the young Asian Catholics.
The Catholic Church has one advantage over the other, as Gary Bomer referred to, the traditional Protestant communities in Australia, and the Catholic Church has a very strong immigrant, first-generation immigrant
base. That's how we started in Australia with your
convicts. Yes, wretched Irish. To basically hold things together. So in a sense, for the Catholic congregational life, leaving aside the broader institutional affairs, there may be more opportunity or a longer period with which to wrestle with this. Or is the same thing happening, basically, essentially an inward-looking? Those first generations basically want the security of what's always been to anchor them.
Well, that's hard to tell, and hard to tell for me from the outside, but certainly the first generation and the young are very involved in the church music, most of which I don't like because I prefer what we sang 30 or 40 years ago, but be it that as it may, they're there every week. They're there singing, they're there involved in the community. They've got youth groups, they have youth camps, they do a lot. So I think it may be almost a repeat of what happened in the early days of our country when we had the Irish, even without priests, many of the convicts, they struggled with their religion without even having priests here to help them with it. And maybe we're going to go along the same pattern, which would be a hopeful outcome.
Keith, that's reflected in a way in the Uniting Church too, with some of the strong Islander communities, for example. Able to establish an internal church life that still resonates culturally for them.
Absolutely, both Islanders and, of course, the South Koreans. Wherever South Koreans go around the world, they always create churches. So that's one of the growth areas for the Uniting Church. Could I also just comment on what Di has just said about the involvement of women in the Catholic Church? If you look at the Uniting Church, we've done that right from the outset. So we have full involvement with women. The first moderator of the New South Wales Uniting Church, for example, the late Lillian Wells, female. So we've involved women, and we are the most open in terms of communion tables. The Catholics can quite often be a little snobbish, only Catholics allowed. The Uniting Church has anybody. And same with marrying people, we marry anybody. So, but we've done all the right things, but it's not reflected in our numbers. So we do involve the women, we're very broad, we're very tolerant, we're very inclusive. Still hasn't worked for us in terms of the numbers.
Gary, sociologically, how does one approach this first? Do you look first at the worshipping and institutional, the worshipping and congregational life of the church to see if it can be in some way remodeled, reshaped to address and make itself relevant to society, or is that game up completely? Has the technological revolution of the last 30 years begun to actually put paid to the notion of people joining groups for any extended period of time? That people are willing to sort of join up contractually, maybe for a year or so on a project, but this idea of living your life through a community, has the world changed so profoundly that is now not an option right across the board? And it's not just churches that applies to.
Well, I think you've touched on a couple of things there. There's the issue of community. There's the issue of information technology changes. They are related. We actually do form communities virtually. Some churches have moved into using those and finding ways to make them work. I don't think it's been explored I suspect in 10 years' time we'll be amazed at what has emerged out of that. And we have to remember that congregational life as we understand it emerged out of a kind of village life where the church played a variety of roles. And the echo of that is there in these buildings we've put around, rather than something that's emerged out of the faith life of a lot of people. If you read the stories of people in the early mid to late 19th century in Australia, early 20th century here, there's a lot of stories about building, deciding to go this way or that, shape it this way or that. It was very interesting and engaged. Once you've inherited that, it's hard to move it around, especially when it's become institutionally frozen. And what's happening now is that those things are being broken apart and things are being questioned or experimented in, left behind in ways that are going to be, I think, amazing, but also will retain in certain very fundamental ways the core connection with sacrament, with the core elements of Christian belief. It will be recognizable, practice, openness to people, engagement, being sent out. I mean, we need to look at our origins to realize how these things emerge out of faith life, and once emerging, can become anchors that hold us back, tent pegs that need pulling up.
Philip Hughes, congregational life is the most obvious way in which the church is expressed. People see people going, pulling up in their cars, going into buildings. Does there need to be a profound shift in the way that congregational life takes place? You are not just somebody who is directing the Christian research activities of the CRA around the country. You're somebody who is an active participant in the life of the church. For you, as you sit there as a member of a congregation, you understand what's going on. But there seems to be increasingly a world, as you've indicated, that doesn't really get what's going on.
I do think that there's been a reformulation of the ways in which people seek meaning and seek well-being and so on, and that it's far more individualistic than it was, rather than found within communities. 23% of Australians see themselves as spiritual but not religious. Now, that means a variety of things for a variety of people, but overall, it means that there's a lot of people who've got some sense of spirituality but don't see it as being expressed well within the within institutional religious structures. And my feeling is, however, that there are ways in which those people do seek to nurture that sense of spirituality. One piece of research that I've been involved in recently has been analysing surveys of school students, mostly from Catholic and Anglican schools. And amongst those students, we found that more are involved in other activities connected with a parish than are involved in Mass. In other words, they're attending small discussion groups. They're involved in social welfare activities. They're being part of music groups and drama groups. They're going to youth groups, but not necessarily going to worship. And it seems to me that that's also happening in the wider adult population, that they're doing finding lots of ways to nurture that sense of spirituality outside of the typical worship congregational life. Now, we are talking here about the mostly the people of Anglo background rather than the immigrants. And certainly one of the factors in the maintenance, which is really masking the decline of the churches, has been the huge impact that immigration has had. Probably added an extra 250,000, 300,000 church attenders within the last 10 years or so. So, but if you look at the Anglos, yes, people are looking at things much more individualistically and experientially and are open to a wide range of resources to nurture that spirituality rather than being part of congregations.
If spirituality is still a lively topic for all Australians, whether they're attached to institutional religion or not, does that not mean that there is a hunger that is somehow the way things are shaped at the moment is not being able to satisfy them? The other thing that seems to me to be relevant to the broader mass of the people who don't go to church these days goes back to Keith, goes back to your idea of the sort of pre-Constantinian Christianity. The earliest days of the church, people are often pointed to sermons that how is it that the church took off? And a verse that's quoted is see these Christians, how they love one another.
That's right.
That is, it was seen as a force that had social relevance then. And that came first. Then came the worshipping community. That is, people were attracted to Christianity through the church in the world. But Keith, you indicated that too has been trapped institutionally into these boxes called social service delivery.
Things. Absolutely. And of course, that's why I come up with that third scenario for the Uniting Church, what I call the early church. So as you say, the first three centuries of the Christian church, the church was persecuted. You're running a risk if you were a Christian. You certainly weren't getting any assistance from the government. And the church flourished. And ultimately, of course, Constantine, for one reason or another, got converted. The problem is that did the emperor convert Christianity or did Christianity convert the emperor?
It's a whole other argument there.
It is. And so we've then gone off at a tangent, being run almost as a subsidiary of government, sometimes running the government, certainly at the moment a subsidiary of government in terms of the delivery of welfare services. I find an interest, as I said, never before we had so many books being published on Jesus. Huge market for an interest in Jesus. Clearly there is something attractive about him, even if the churches themselves are unattractive.
Dichotomy, that's even been seen in almost the weekly statements of Pope Francis. They head in that direction. That is, it's not about we in here, it's about the world out there.
The world out there, yes. And we have great hope and optimism with Pope Francis. I was so excited when I heard that he'd insisted on having showers built outside the Vatican area so that the homeless people could have a shower and then come and see him. I mean, he's really down to earth and he's going after this search for communal spirituality. And I think this is very interesting looking back at how these Christians love one another, because I think that's what most people still want to do. They want to be involved together communally in doing something. And it's interesting that the young could be involved in doing social welfare or music clubs or singing in a choir or something like that. I met my husband singing in a church choir. But it's all about people needing each other as well as their spirituality and needing God, I believe.
That needing each other these days has to take place out there because so many people aren't coming in here.
That's right. And they're not finding what they need inside many of the institutions, yes.
Does this go to another point, Gary, that you were making, that what's going on inside the church on a Sunday, that is what is being preached to people really for the last 50 years, certainly, or perhaps the last 80 years, has been about defending the perimeters of the building. And that's part of the reason why we've got aged congregations, because it's been about basically keeping this a safe and secure place for we who are here.
I think you put your finger on it. It's preaching. You see, if worship is preaching, then you've become a real British Protestant, a good Presbyterian. even Salvos are known for this now. But I mean that because what experience do you have? If you've left the liturgy behind, if you haven't got an ongoing church year and other kinds of communal engagement, yes, Catholics have maintained it, Anglicans, at least non-Sydney-styled Anglicans maintain it. But it's an experience. And if that, when we were dealing with that kind of Christianity I described, that preaching was part of a rational order, as Philip said, seeking meaning. You got a rational answer. It was laid out in 3 points. It was well done. It was well grounded. And you can still get that if you go to the average Uniting Church. But it's boring to people who want an experience. Now, Carmody was complaining about the experiential music going around, and I think a lot of it's less than Palestrina, yes. But it's a different kind of thing. People want an engagement with God. Now, how do you work that experience, both communally, offering it individually, offering it electronically, you know, offering it digitally? How do you make that connection available is the great challenge. And communally, yes, but the communion may not last very long. Young people aren't going to sign on forever, but they'll sign on for Tuesday. And they'll sign on for a few neo-monastic kinds of things that last a short while. But if we're talking about signing on forever, no, that's not the way it goes. But it's a very interesting creative mix. Yes, there's yearning. Yes, there's always searching because there's always imperfection. There's always failure. There's always the yearning for something new. It is Advent, after all. We say, come, Lord, come quickly, because it's a mess. And in that context, there's always need.
Does this, in fact, not put the onus back on the church very heavily? That is, if we're entering into a world where people are saying, look, I'm prepared to listen to you, but I don't want to hear you lecture me. I want you to show me. And if you show me, if you demonstrate by their fruits you shall know them, to quote another, then that is what society is looking for in any institution. And that's in some ways what congregational life has to do. It has to provide a way of people being able to demonstrate, to be outside the building rather than inside the building.
I think the problem with that reasoning, certainly from the United Church point of view, is that we're an aging congregation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. When you think that the Uniting Church, when it was established back in 1977, was full of energy and people were creating the first ever Australian-made Uniting Church, what I see now, for those who are still alive, is just a general sense of people getting old. They are more self-absorbed. It's more difficult to get them engaged in sort of the broader social justice agenda with which I've been associated, not because they're hostile. It's just because age is catching up with them.
Is that because in joining three traditions, you had to bland it out, and so that there was no bite left, that the sort of the distinctive elements went?
And there may be an element of that. I think that there are people like myself who would call themselves continuing Methodists, and I think you've got others who are hardline Presbyterians, but I think it's much more fundamental than just those different cultural issues, John. I think the fact is that, demographically speaking, we are the oldest church in Australia, the newest in terms of creation, but the oldest in terms of demographic profile.
Di, when you go to a congregation, when you go to Mass on Sunday, what do you look for? What's still the essence for you?
It is a feeling of community. It's a feeling of enjoying the ritual and feeling that the congregation that is in the church are in there together. And that is one of the things I find is sometimes lacking, that you're not really feeling that you are part of what's going on the altar. You are when you go to communion, and you are when you give the sign of peace. But that is about all. Yes, of course, we answer and sing and all of that too, but you're not really invited to be part of what's going on. And that's why I think, even though we now have some women servers on the altar, I do really believe that we should try much harder to have women invited to be a much more part of the ritual and the planning of services and increasing the community.
Over the past year in this program, we've had three or four international theologians and missiologists from Miroslav Volf and others talking on this program. All of them have said, put in shorter or longer forms, an expression that if the church is to survive, it's got to get used to getting out of the building, that it must express itself in civil society in some way. This is where it began, this is where it needs to continue. Gary, you've mentioned that the problems of this, because once you try and get yourself out of the building, then what's holding you together? What are the central tenets that bring you together? And everybody says, oh, it's the message of Jesus. But as Keith indicates, there's books written about Jesus are a dime a dozen. Every one of them has a different take on the essential message of Jesus. Are we looking at a period when the whole, if we can talk about religious institutional education for the moment, the whole emphasis really needs to shift pretty profoundly to missiology? That is, what the dickens are we doing in talking to the world?
You started with a very bad place, and it's unfortunately where many people start, and that's survival, if the church is to survive. If that's what we're about, close it now. It really needs to just give up. If it's not about survival, but doing the things that people are called to do, whether they are 92 or 19, and yes, the calling may differ, and getting out into the world, engaging. But getting out also presupposes there's a place to move from. And that's the contradiction. We do move from, as you say, places that we gather, places that nurture, how much we spend on them. We spend obscene amounts of money keeping up old buildings that ought to be allowed to fall down in some cases, as opposed to engaging in ministry in the community. That whole business of how you engage and move out is a architectural problem, is a theological problem, is a missiological problem, it's a pastoral problem. And what's happened, I think, is that the church has folded in on itself, worried about will it survive, and having survival strategies which get in the way of genuine growth, genuine engagement, and providing an experience of ongoing nurturing, ongoing developing faith that can actually change through time and change through encounter, as opposed to being the same old since Tuesday.
Let me put a couple of scenarios to you. One of the areas in which the church was most relevant through much of perhaps the past 400 or 500 years has been coming to terms with critical issues as they arose, because the church was so much embedded in the governance of society. Di, you mentioned women and the place of women in the church. Despite the fact that some churches were very tardy on the process, the role of women in society was very much helped by movements within the church, particularly in the United States in the 1840s and 1850s, linked to the anti-slavery movement and the equality of rights for all. The church was there in civil society, and in some ways it maintained its relevance to civil society through that. After the 1860s and right up to perhaps the 1950s, you had what many saw as the Great Withdrawal, the church turning inwards on itself for all sorts of reasons, challenges about evolution, and the Catholic Church had one version of it, the Protestant churches went through another version of it. We're now seeing a reemergence of critical civil society issues which are profoundly, in a sense, theological. You've had, for example, young kids or around the church in the last couple of months, old people and young people, arrested on the supporting refugees. This week, some of them were arrested and even strip searched, yet very little coverage in the press. You had the women's issue, as I earlier indicated, being one that was a key issue for the church, which has become the dominant theme of the 20th century, or the last part of the 20th century for the church. What's emerging now is a very fundamental one: climate, environment. Now, here surely are latchkeys that can help the church reconnect or open the stable door
This is what the church should be doing, I believe. And this is when you were talking about the pre-Constantinian era and how it flourished because it was being persecuted. We really need a motive to bind us all together, and it's issues like climate change and the way we're treating the refugees could well be the issues that would bind all the churches together in terms of leading the moral way of society. And in fact, you mentioned earlier the 17th and 18th century was the Catholic Church in many ways, way back then, was the beginning of the whole social welfare movement. The almoner. I used to be an almoner many, many years ago because that was named after, you know, going to the monastery for alms. Now we're doing very well, and I acknowledge Uniting Church, Uniting Care, absolutely brilliant as a social worker. We all depend on them. But also we use Vinnies, we use the Salvation Army. We are very aware as social workers how important the churches, all the churches are in terms of helping people that are in need. But
That's
institutional. We are still not addressing the two biggest issues, as you say, that confront society now. That is the total injustice that is being done to refugees and our ability to try and pretend climate change isn't happening. And that is really to do with the whole future of the world. And this, I think, is where all the churches should be leading the way.
And it's the...
I fully agree with Di on this one, except I want the history corrected.
Oh, sorry.
On every one of these major issues in the past, the church has been on both sides. And I get tired of the church taking credit for ending slavery when the church was equally there trying to keep slavery going. It's only the winners that get to write the history. I'm on the favor of getting rid of slavery, promoting women, and certainly taking care of refugees and climate change, addressing that. But we have got opposition from within that is very, very serious, and we have to be honest about our history, not claim credit only for those nice things that we won.
We have to fight our history for that.
You better believe it, and I'm with you.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was Tony Campolo, the man who was called in as Bill Clinton's father confessor in his moment of fall from grace, who once said, every great conservative stands on the grave of a dead radical. Keith, the key ways forward for you, things like the environment, like refugee issues, are these ways of galvanising that puts the church back into a place where it needs to be?
Well, don't forget, I was employed by the Uniting Church 30 years ago to do precisely that. I think the big difference for us today is trying to find out a language which the church can use, which is both relevant for its faith and what will be understood by the ordinary person in the street. So if you were to say, we are called to be stewards of the earth to take care of it, I think the media, collectively, the eyes would just simply glaze over. So it's very difficult to fashion a Christian message that will be relevant to today's hardliners in the media who just simply are not interested in what the church has to say on any issue. If you think back to a few decades ago, the sermons of the Archbishop of Sydney used to be published in the Sydney Morning Herald. Nowadays, they don't care at all. They don't even have a religious correspondent in the Sydney Morning Herald. So the risk for the churches is that, and I obviously support getting involved in these issues, but I'm just simply saying the risk for us is trying to come up with a language that is meaningful to us and which will also resonate with a secular, jaded audience.
Philip Hughes, as a researcher, are there any straws in the wind for you as the way forward on the church re-engaging, reconnecting with the world in a relevant sense?
We looked at the issue of environment recently through a survey, a national survey, and we were sad to find that those who were involved in the churches were actually less involved in environmental issues and less positive about environmental issues than the people who were not involved in the churches. I mean, the part of the issue here is that large numbers of people have... are connecting with those issues without any reference to the church and don't see any need for reference to the church in them. I still believe that the going back to the fundamental sort of reason for the church has to do with the meaning of life and finding a sense of meaning. And my sense is that the social issues, while they may arise out of that, are not going to be the issues which actually bring vitality back into the churches themselves.
And what for you is the key to that vitality, observationally?
Observationally, I think that the key to that vitality is people finding a sense of meaning and in their lives experientially, something that nurtures the spirit, something that builds community, and perhaps then, for at least some people out of that, there's a sense of mission to the wider community in terms of social justice issues and other things.
Is there also a need for a sense of I am part of a movement as a member of a church that is going somewhere? Look, this applies to any sort of social movement, whether it's the Labour Party or the Liberal Party or whomever. The frustration, say, of the Labour Party is it's lost any sense of coherence and direction. It's lost its ideology.
The light on the hill.
The light on the hill has grown dim. And that seemed to me to be the singular thing which came out of much of the discussion about Francis. It's like... You know, Pope John the 23rd, he turned on the light. He stopped us driving in a rear vision mirror. And I think that was actually a John the 23rd phrase. You don't go forward through looking in the rear vision mirror.
That's right. And it felt to many of us as if we had that all turned back after we lost John the 23rd. And it's just been static for a long time. And therefore, there was great excitement amongst many people when Pope Francis became Pope. And we are still hopeful that there will be steps forward in these justice issues and the real importance of getting people into community again, because I do believe that just as we yearn for spirituality, we also yearn for communality. We do yearn to be part of a group, but we need to like the group and have share values with the rest of the group if we want to stay in it.
What I'm getting towards, finally, is how you establish a sense of coherence and establish what the key lights on the hill are that enable people to say, this is something I want to bind myself to.
Yeah. Well, in my doctorate, I argue the problem for the Uniting Church is that we don't have any clear mechanism for doing that. We have annual assemblies, we have synods, we have devolved power, we have committees. And really, that's why I'm fairly pessimistic about the future of the Uniting Church. But I also end my doctorate by saying, let's look at the broader church. There are more Christians in the world than ever before. There are more Methodists, for example, in the world than ever before. We've got, in Britain, of course, more Muslims than there are Methodists, the home of Methodism. But we have huge numbers of Christians throughout Asia, Africa, Latin America, where they've just provided the first pope. So the Christian church is growing rapidly around the world. Perhaps one of the things for the Uniting Church would be to look at how it can wind down some of its own assets and go where the strength is, which is increasingly in the developing countries.
Gary Bowman, some final observations from you.
The Pope is a marvelous example of a deeply spiritual, deeply prayerful, liturgically integrated person who is also personally and institutionally engaged in engaging people, giving them a very real experience of a connection with a God who forgives, who accepts, who gives love unconditionally. That can be expressed in that way and in a myriad other ways, and that's what the church needs to do.
Philip Hughes, where do you see the signs of that?
I think they're many and various, and that the perhaps we won't call some of them church, but as people gather together in small groups and in larger groups, as they give each other strength, as they care for each other, as they engage with the issues and so on, and do so out of the values and passion of faith, I think the church finds its expression. But in some ways, some of that, at least, is going to bypass some of the institutional structures.
Di Carmody, you're somebody who's looking at a bright new future. You have a new pope, a new archbishop in Sydney, where you've where you live and found your life in the church. What's the most optimistic thing, and a final word, the most optimistic thing you look forward to as you're seeing the church in this period of sort of potential new growth, new things happening? What's the key to new evangelization, if I had to put it that way for you?
Is to understand the need for people to be part of a group, because I'm a group worker and that's very important. And I do think that we do need to join together in, and I'm hoping that Pope Francis may be a little bit of a help for the light of the hill, and that as all the churches may well unite.
Thank you all for joining us. We've run out of time. It's been great to have Di Carmody with us, also Dr. Gary Bomer, Dr. Philip Hughes and Dr. Keith Suter. Keith Suter's The Future of the Uniting Church in Australia. Gary Bomer's The Church and Sociocultural Change. Thank you all.